Hello, and welcome to the Bailey Group's Leverage podcast series. My name is Michael Kifkart, and today I will be interviewing Raj Shah, the founder and CEO of MyMeds.
Are you familiar with the author Abraham Verghese, who's the cutting for stone? Because he too is a practicing physician, and he teaches at Stanford, and then he writes these, you know, not little books, really huge. And so I just wanted...
Well, he's from Africa too. I think he was born in Tanzania or something.
In Ethiopia.
Was he Ethiopian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I just wonder what kind of makeup it takes for an individual like you, like him, that can be good at multiple things. Like, where do you think that comes from?
I think it just comes from drive, right? I mean, Asian mentality is you have to be excellent at everything. And that's sort of drilled into your head from day one. And I think that that's problematic for some Asian kids who just don't, they're just not programmed that way. And some of them just aren't smart. I mean, it's okay when you've got a billion people, some of them just aren't smart. And but the reality is it's the values, the cultural values on education and success and family are really what drive all of that. And I think that when you look around, it doesn't matter where you're from, what you look like, it's still what I consider Asian values. So it could be a kid in Minnesota like Blois, he's got Asian values. And you could be from Ethiopia and still have Asian values. And you could be from Venezuela and have the same thing. It doesn't matter, because the concept of doing the best you can do, working hard, and taking advantage of the opportunities that are around you are what make you successful. Because a lot of people, there's opportunities all around. They either don't know, or they don't use them, and
or they can't see it.
Yeah. And that's what everything in life happens for a reason. You meet people for a reason. You see people for a reason. You go places, and things happen for a reason. I mean, I met my wife randomly in a restaurant in St. Louis, and when you hear the whole story, you think, "What the hell? This is nuts," because it's fate. And when you think of the people who I met in the past that helped me get to where I am today, it's all meant to be, and that's how I feel. So I think that, again, you meet people, you have experiences, and then what you make out of that is what makes you. And I think the successful people take all those things and make it work.
Would it be safe to assume that there's another company after MyMeds in you?
Yep. I have a baby-based company already in the works in my head. Because after, after having the kids and seeing, something, it's one of those things that, I was talking to someone about it. They're like, the difference between you and other people is people think about stuff and they're like, oh, that would be good. He's like, but you actually go do it.
Right.
And I think the reason I go do it is because A, I want to, but B, I've got a good support network that allows me to do stuff. And I would never have started ACES if I had to get a job when I graduated college. My parents supported me and supported ACES initially to make it work. For my meds, the initial money was money my dad gave me for med school that I used for a different purpose,
Yeah.
But again, it's because I had the support and I had the ability to use that support to do something. And my dad is always of the opinion, he'd tell my brother, he's like, look, just do anything. It doesn't matter if you succeed or fail, just do it. And if you fail, then learn from it and do something else. And our family, we're from Uganda. I was fourth generation born there, and my dad moved there in the 50s because someone said there's good business opportunity. And he was an accountant, so he started an accounting practice there. And he ended up meeting Milton Obote, who ended up being the president. And then all the business went to my dad. And then, you know, the life he led, this crazy life that, you know, you hear about now. But, I mean, it was a globe-trotting life. And then he, Obote was overthrown.
By Museveni?
No, by Idi Amin.
Oh, first Amin, okay.
And so Idi Amin came in and my
killed
dad
everybody.
Killed everybody, except my dad was not part of the government, so he didn't get killed. But then Amin and his people became my dad's clients. And so then there was, you know, my dad was Idi Amin's accountant, basically. You know, he was the external auditor for the country. And then in 71, they kicked all the Israelis out. 72, they kicked all the Indians out. And in 71, my parents were on a trip around the world, stopped in London, and my mom said, maybe we should buy a house. And he's like, what do you mean? She's like, there's this unrest. And he said, I think I would know if something's going on, but they ended up buying a house. And a year later, my mom's family of four generations moved into that house because everyone was kicked out. And my dad, there was multiple properties. Every night was in a different property, and every night he would try to call my mom. And then there was a period of time that there was no call, so they just assumed he was dead. And he was sending bags of cash with people and tells you, you know, it's a learning lesson, right?
Mm-hmm.
You find out who your friends are, because a lot of people just took the cash for themselves because everyone was desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And so here we are living in this really nice house in London with no money. And my dad had to go from, you know, having 50 people working for him to being a clerk because he wasn't certified in London. So then he had to pass his chartered accountancy. Then we moved to Canada because the weather wasn't good. So they moved to Winnipeg where we had family friends.
Cold.
And but he had to pass the CA in Canada because there's no reciprocity. And then my uncles, who were doctors here, said, come to the States, there's more opportunity. And Minneapolis was the closest big city, so he came here. And he had to pass a CPA. And so each time he had to start all over again. And but because of education, everyone's able to rebuild, right? And so education, work ethic, persistence, taking advantage of opportunities. And when he moved here, he felt racism, a lot of racism. And
more than he did in other places.
Yeah, for sure. And then, you know, Minnesota in the early 80s was not the most welcoming place for other people. So he ended up calling some senator from New York who came to Uganda after the first pope came to Uganda. So the first, I might be wrong on this as far as if it's the first pope or not, but Uganda had a lot of Catholic missionaries. So one of the first papal trips to Africa was to Uganda. And my dad was president of the Rotary and was immunizing all the kids in the country against polio. So he met with the Pope, who said this is wonderful, gave him the money to do it, and gave him a little medal for his humanitarian work. And so fast forward to ACES in 1994, and I moved back from college and I wanted to do something, and many of their friends in London were like, why are you helping black people? They ruined our lives. And I said, they might have ruined your life, and it's true, but it's 22 years later, you gotta move on with your life. And my organization isn't just for black people, it's for all people, and we're gonna help everyone who needs help. And my dad, that's when he started to tell me stories. I never knew any of this about our entire family history until I moved back from college. And then he started talking about all these things. And then you hear about meeting a pope, and you hear about immunizing the kids, and you hear about all these things, and then you wonder, all right, well, that explains why he's so supportive of what I'm doing, because he did it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yes, that's an amazing.
And so that's the whole story of how we got to where we are and why he's so supportive of trying new things and doing new things, because you have to be that way.
And so you knew that you came back from college that you wanted to help people. You wanted to do something. How did ACES come about, helping middle school children and having athletes engage with them?
In ninth grade, we had shadow day. I mentioned that earlier. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I knew I was going to be a doctor, so I was interested in banking. And so my dad met Carl Pollard somewhere, I think at Kiwanis or something like mm-hmm. that. And
did he stay in Rotary when he came to the States?
I have no idea.
Okay.
He stayed in Masonic stuff. He's a Mason.
Wow.
But anyway, so I called Carl at home and said, you know, I want to learn about banking. And I initially started talking to Eloise, his wife, on the phone. She's like, that sounds really interesting. So then Carl got on the phone and said, this is a good idea. And then they set up an entire day of banking for me. So I started the day with Carl, then went around with their youngest employee, because I was 13, and learned all about banking and every aspect of it. And then ended the day with Carl, and then he said, you know, if you ever want to call me after 5, because I answer my own phone after 5. And so then we kept in touch, we'd talk, and then that was the beginning of our friendship. And so then, you know, I went to the World Series, and he sponsored me for the Minnesota Teen Leadership Conference when I graduated. And that's when he learned about my integrity, because he gave me too much money. I said, no, that's not what I asked for. So I gave back the check and asked for a new one. And then when I went to college in Boston, and when the Twins won in 91, he sent me a package of some World Series stuff saying, you know, since you couldn't come, I thought I'd send some of the series to you. And then when I graduated college, he set up an internship with the team doctor, and I didn't get into med school. And so I needed to do something. I wanted to do something with education because of our family background. And Rhoda, my partner who started ACES with me, her family had a similar story from Taiwan with the revolution. So I said, look, I've got a connection. I can do anything I want to do as long as I know exactly what I want to do. So we wrote a full business plan. I sent it to Carl. He sent it to Jerry Bell. He sent it to Major League Baseball. Then Dave St. Peter called me and said, this is too much for us. I said, well, let's figure out how to make it work. And we decided we wanted sports because kids, even if they hate sports, they like celebrity. And if you provide attention and rewards and things like that, kids will relate. So it all goes back to psychology.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we designed ACES around educational and psychological principles. And next thing you know, we're the first program in the history of pro sports to unite all the teams. So we had the Twins, Timberwolves, and Vikings here, eventually got the rest. We expanded to 6 cities around the country. That's the story. I remember the day that I decided nephrology was, this kid came in, and I was on the ICU rotation. I must have been the senior resident. And this kid came in, Somali, 20 years old or so, and he came to the urgent care. And he'd been in there 3 weeks before with back pain. So they gave him ibuprofen, 800 milligrams, 3 times a day, which was standard for that kind of thing. And then 3 weeks later, he came back, and he's nauseous, he's vomiting, he feels like crap. And his labs came back, and they're all completely whacked. You know, his kidney function was basically zero. His blood pressure was super high. And so he was admitted to the ICU, to my team. You know, we did ultrasounds and things like that, and found out that he had one kidney that was congenitally scarred down, and the other one, which he'd been living on for 20 years, was also small, but the ibuprofen knocked it out. So he ended up, the first night, he ended up having a seizure, got intubated, which is put on a ventilator. They did an MRI, and he had Press syndrome, which is the first time I'd seen that, which is a distinct look on the MRI from high blood pressure. And then he started to get better with dialysis. And I followed him along, and then he obviously didn't want to be on dialysis. So his family held a fundraiser And they raised $9,000, and then he went to Pakistan and bought a kidney on the black market and came back with a kidney that unfortunately was infected, but he got treated for that, and, you know, here he is living a normal life.
He is.
And he's back here. I don't see him anymore, but, you know, from what I heard last, his kidney's functioning, and, you know, the whole notion of acute renal failure to chronic failure to dialysis to transplant to a relatively normal life, except you got to take a lot of meds, mm-hmm. and the whole time I get to be his doctor. So I get that relationship, which is long term, mm-hmm. and everything that I'm interested in is about relationships, and so everything I've ever done is based on relationships, and so it just really fit. And then that cemented my desire to change to nephrology, and mm-hmm. HCMC is actually one of the leading centers in the world for kidney research.
Wow.
And no one would know that because it's a county hospital in Minneapolis, but it's where everyone in the world comes for training. And so
it's right in your backyard.
Yeah. And so that's when I changed to nephrology, and I just like the nephrologist. I mean, I'm a nerd and I like other nerds, and there wasn't that arrogance, and people just worked and did what they do, and it was pretty cool.
So that would sounds like a kind of a very defining moment, like almost life-changing.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I'll never forget.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the clarity in which you can tell the story, too.
And that was, you know, 15 years ago. So that's, but I can still see the exact scenario in my head. I can see what room he was in and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So. And so you had this patient for an extended period of time?
Yeah, I saw him over a period of 5 years.
Okay.
And then when I left Hennepin, of course, I never saw him again. But
mm-hmm. When you think, kind of fast forward then to starting to create My Meds, was there any connection with that experience? Because you said, you know, he's going to be on meds for the rest of his life and a fair amount. Did his image or your experience with him, did that carry through? Or was there another patient that kind of stayed with you as you developed My Meds?
No, I think it wasn't really any one patient. It was more the concept of people and their role in healthcare. Because at the end of the day, you're your biggest advocate, or you should be.
Mm-hmm.
And doctor knows best, medicine doesn't exist anymore. And if you're over 65, you're a doctor knows best person. You do what you're told because my doctor said so. If you're under 65, and as you get younger in age, as an adult, you start questioning things. And now with the internet and the accessibility to information, people are looking stuff up themselves. They're questioning, well, I don't know if I want this medicine and that medicine. And so you really have to educate people as partners in their care in order to do it. So what I was seeing is this movement of people coming in with their paper and pencil lists, and they're scratching stuff out, and it's like all wrong. And at that point, we were in a point and click world, and I was like, we're not paper pencil, this is archaic. So let's think of how can we make this easier for patients, and let's look at point and click. And more importantly, let's look at caregivers, because women are caregivers for men more often than not,
mm-hmm.
and you'd see these old ladies taking care of their husbands, because the husband's like, I don't know, ask her. You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
And then you'd see mothers taking care of their kids, and then you would just see the patients and the changing nature of patients. And so that's what really drove My Meds. But what you mentioned, To Err Is Human, and that report, which came out in 2000, I think, that was defining for me, because it was 125,000 people a year dying of preventable medical errors.
Yeah.
And that was only in the inpatient setting. Mm-hmm. It didn't count the millions of people who weren't dying but were hospitalized because of medication errors outside of the hospital. And at the end of the day, you know, if all three of us are doctors, you could see me, you could see Blois, you could see you, you get a bunch of different prescriptions, and systems don't talk to each other. And even now, if you're in an integrated system, it's better, but it's still not always perfect. And so you need one person to be the repository of that information, and that person is the patient or their caregiver, because they're the constant in all of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that really took me, was a big deal for me, because it was sort of, patients should be their biggest advocates. They're the constant in who they see, and if we can make it easier for them, then you can achieve patient safety.
Right.
So.
Well, I was interested to see that you have a background in cognitive psychology as well as internal medicine, and so when you're going through this and starting to think about my meds, it really is about knowing human behavior, right? So tell us a little bit about how that kind of played into this. What did you discover about human behavior in creating MyMeds that kind of surprised you, even having that level of understanding from a theoretical, intellectual perspective?
Well, I think the biggest thing that surprised me is even people who have transplants, which, you know, this is your second chance on life,
mm-hmm.
and the only cost is taking the medicines, and they have side effects, but you're alive.
Right.
And even then, people wouldn't take their medicines properly. And so a lot of people say, well, that's just implicit. You should just know that. Like, mm-hmm. that's important. It's keeping me alive. But if you get lazy, if you feel like, oh, I'm cured because I have a transplant and I feel great, people forget that the reason you feel great is these medicines are keeping things working.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first big learning moment, is even people who theoretically should have the most invested in this aren't doing what they're supposed to do. And then when you look at the reasons why they're not doing what they do, memory plays a big role. So there's five reasons people don't take their medicines properly. One is they forget, so they need daily reminders.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they forget to refill on time, so there's a gap, mm-hmm. and they run out of meds in that gap. Three is they just don't understand why they're taking a medicine. And you would think that even diabetics, where you take insulin or you take a medicine to control your sugars, 50% of people don't take their medicines for diabetes properly.
Yes.
And a lot of it is they just don't understand why that is.
Mm-hmm.
But now if you're on a medicine like Atenolol, which is a blood pressure pill, but there's six reasons you could be on this medicine, you have to pick one that's most important to you. So if you understand why you take a medicine, you're much more likely to take it.
Okay.
And that's where the cognitive psychology comes in, because when my background is cognitive psychology with a focus on memory creation.
Okay.
And when you think about creating memories lead to behavior change. Because if you can personalize something to you, it's all of a sudden important to you. And anything that's more important to you, you're going to do. Because people don't always care about what's important to the hospital or the doctor or the system or whatever, but they always care about what's important to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can help them attribute importance to the medicine and do it in a way that makes sense clinically as well, then you're going to drive the behavior change. So if you help someone understand what they take and why they take it, as soon as they understand why they take it, they know that if I take this medicine, it's going to prevent me from feeling badly later on.
Mm-hmm.
So the intrinsic motivator is, this medicine is going to help me not feel bad. Intrinsic motivation changes behaviors for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
Extrinsic motivators you have to bring in. So those are the rewards, the gamification of the world, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And you need that, but that doesn't bring long-lasting change. The way to change behavior is intrinsic motivation, by personalizing something so it's important to you. So that's what we did with MyMeds. And then the other two reasons, just to complete the list, are cost and side effects.
Okay.
But if you understand why you're taking a medicine and why it's important, people are willing to put up with some of the side effects, because they recognize that this is good for me in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And same with cost. You know, they'll sacrifice a little bit if they have to. But again, the number one two reasons are related to memory. So if you drive that memory change, you're more likely to succeed.
Yeah. I was really struck with the first three reasons that you gave, that they forget there's that gap, so maybe there's some procrastination in there, and that they don't understand why, that now you translate that to leading teams. And because those are things that we see all the time in the challenges of trying to get a group of people to do things differently for a different outcome. And so I'm wondering, is your, you know, now an entrepreneur, you still have teams, I would think, within your physician practice, and you have the nonprofit that you started 20 years ago. How do you see similarities between leading people forward and some of the behavior that you've identified here with your creation of MyMeds?
So I think, you know, I do have a weird life in a sense, because I run a practice, so it's different, because managing doctors can sometimes be difficult, because everyone's
I'm
sure and you know, everyone's a number one, mm-hmm. and we give orders and they're followed, mm-hmm. and if they're not, people get mad, and doctors have been known to throw fits and
display bad behavior.
Yeah, and I would say that our group's pretty good. We don't really have a lot of that, but then you're also managing the staff, because it's a totally different thing. And then at ACES, we have people in the nonprofit sector who are fundamentally different than people in the for-profit sector, because their motivations are different. And then at MyMeds, we have people who also have different motivations. Some are money, some are getting in on the ground floor of something cool and helping create, some are just there for a job. Mm-hmm. But I think that the thing that I do between all of these is you got to have a vision, and people have to buy into your vision. Mm-hmm. If they don't buy into their your vision, then they got to go. Mm-hmm. So that's the first screen. Because if it's my company and I've created it, then this is the vision that we're going to follow. Mm-hmm. And I'm not set in stone about stuff, but if you're not pretty clear about what your vision is and you waffle a little bit, you don't win. Mm-hmm. And so I'm pretty clear and direct about this is the end goal. What I let people do is then figure out how they want to get to the end goal. And the only parameters I put around it are honesty, integrity, and be nice. You know what I mean? Like, those are the three things. And I don't micromanage people. I'll oversee things, and I'll have them present ideas to me, and we'll go back and forth. But I tell people, I don't want yes people. I want people who are going to challenge what I say, and I'm going to challenge what you say. And if you are bothered by that, well, this may not be the right place for you. Mm-hmm. But I definitely give people a lot of autonomy, sometimes too much autonomy, and that can cause problems later on. But I think that if you know, going back to cognitive psychology, if someone feels something is important and they own it, they're much more likely to do a better job. Mm-hmm. And so rather than being directive of you're going to do this in this way, it's let's come up with the goals together. If I don't like what I hear, I'll kind of maneuver with people to get them to think differently. Mm-hmm. And then when we set the 3 to 5 goals, then I say, what are you going to do to get there? And then I don't say anything, because that has to be their way of doing it. And even if I disagree, I don't say anything, because they have to make their own mistakes. Because otherwise, it's one of these, you're a know-it-all pain in the ass, and no one wants right. that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we see it quite a bit, actually. So how else would you describe your leadership style? Or if I asked someone that worked for you, how do you think they would describe it?
Depending on the context, mm-hmm. and who you're asking, if you're talking to sort of people I consider the leaders, they would say he's pretty hands-off, but accessible. And if you talk to people farther down, they'll say he's intimidating and directive, largely because I don't get involved in what they do, and when they see me, it's different. And I don't see it that way, because we used to run into this at ACES, where I'd walk in and I'd say something and everyone would jump. And I didn't know they were jumping.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my mind, I was like, well, I'm just a guy talking. But in their mind, you're the founder and chairman.
Right.
So I was always treated differently. And I never understood it until I finally understood it.
Your words have different weight.
Yeah. And so then I would just not say anything until someone asked me. And then and that made a big difference in how we do things. But again, I think, like, at my meds, I'm pretty inclusive. Like, we have team meetings where everyone comes and everyone knows what we're doing, from raising money to customers to development, because we're still small enough that I think everyone needs to be involved.
Mm-hmm.
There obviously are meetings where I don't involve people, and, you know, they don't come to board meetings and things like that, and I have different conversations at the board than I do with our QA guy.
Sure.
But at the same time, everyone has to feel like they're part of the team to ensure that we move forward, because we're at a critical point, and you can't have too much sway from the vision. Mm-hmm. Right now.
How big is your team at MyMeds?
We're up to 10 with us. If you count all the developers and stuff, it's like 20, 22 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. But how many would you say is like your key team that you meet with the most?
So
that's still a pretty big team for...
For now, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to grow this year, but we're also going to bring in a different CEO. Because even though I've done a good job to get us to where we are,
mm-hmm.
To get to the next level, we need to bring someone in who has different experiences than I do. And I'm totally fine with that.
Well, let's talk about how you came to that conclusion, because that can be really difficult to be the founder of a company and recognize that you're maybe not the best person to get the company to where it needs to go next. How did you discover that? And
well, I think we've always talked about it at the board level, and having gone through it at ACES, I've already done it once, you know. And I think that one thing that, when you talk to other people, one thing I'm good at is I know what I'm good at, and I know what I'm not good at.
That's huge.
When I know what I'm not good at, that's when I build around myself. You know, so that was the first thing. The second thing is recognizing that, you know, when you're raising venture capital money, there's a formula, and I don't fit the formula. And if we...
Why don't you fit the formula?
I'm a doctor, so no one believes doctors can do anything in business.
Okay.
Second, I've never had a venture-funded company that I've taken to exit before. Third, the fact that I still practice bothers some people.
Okay.
Even though we see it as a competitive advantage, because I get a private lab where I can test everything in real time.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if I were to give that up, we would lose a competitive advantage. So you kind of have to pick and choose what you're going to do. And I think that competitive advantage is too great to give up. And so let's find someone to run the business and scale the business. And also someone, you know, I've never worked in insurance and I've never worked in PBMs. So that's been a learning curve for me already. But to have someone come in who knows that space, they're our customers, so knows our customers and can speak to them, it just sends a different level of credibility.
Okay.
So I think that's where we've recognized that. And but the hard part is finding the right fit for someone in Minnesota, because trying to get people to come to Minnesota is very difficult.
And do you feel like for you to get the right next CEO that you have to extend beyond the state to find that person?
Yep, for sure, because we're digital health IT. I mean, digital health IT is on the coasts. We've sort of been under the radar here,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I think there's a big competitive advantage to being in Minnesota. I mean, we have Mayo, mm-hmm. United Health. Health Partners is considered one of the most innovative health plans in the country. You've got OptumRx and Prime Therapeutics, two of the top five PBMs in the country, headquartered here. You've got all the device companies. So, I mean, there's a ton of medical stuff going on here. And it's interesting that the investors in healthcare, which are Boston, San Francisco, and New York-based, and Chicago to a certain degree, and now Nashville's growing, they all consider Minneapolis one of the top markets. Yet investors here don't feel the same about health IT. They feel the same about devices, of course, because this is a device town. But what we're doing, you need to find someone who's outside the box.
Mm-hmm. When you just rattled off a number of key healthcare organizations that are based here, when you look at the healthcare industry as a whole, being a leader in it yourself, what do you think is going to be required of the leadership in healthcare going forward as you all navigate a very large degree of uncertainty?
I think the most important thing for any leader, whether it's a health plan, a health system, a startup company, or a established healthcare company, device or other, is everything that's happened to date may not be happening in the future. So you can't hold on to the traditions of the past.
Mm-hmm.
The core values you must hold on to, and your core business, obviously, you got to continue. But you have to be able to think and innovate and move quickly. And that's something that large companies don't do, is they don't move quickly.
It's not typically known of your industry as a whole, either. No.
The healthcare industry is so far behind. But I think what's going to happen in the industry is what happened in the third world. So years ago, think of India or different parts of Africa, there are no landlines. So what their leadership did was say, screw it. The hell with landlines. We're going straight to, mobile.
Yeah.
Everyone has a mobile phone. You know what I mean? You could be in the desert in Africa and someone has a phone.
Right.
But there's no landlines. But I think that's what's going to have to happen in healthcare, is eventually someone's going to have to say, you know what? We're just not going to invest in these current things. We're just going to put our time and money into the next thing. And whoever does that, I think, is really going to be an interesting leader in the future. When you think of EMRs, so Epic runs the world, right? 60% of this country is Epic. But the Epic system, it's coded on something called MUMPS, it's archaic.
Okay.
And it's not cloud-based. They don't integrate with anybody because they're Epic. They don't have to. In New York, they've been forced by the health systems. It's the only state that's forcing Epic to integrate with companies like ours, which are startups. Because the startups are going to have the new cool thing and the mindset and the technology down here. And the other guys are still stuck in the middle, so they're too far away. But the reality is anyone who can figure the integration with EMRs is going to be huge. You look at Athena Health, which is cloud-based already. They're also funded by some really innovative Silicon Valley people. Venrock is a big investor in theirs. Jonathan Bush has done crazy stuff. I've never met him, but I know people who do know him. And, he's a forward thinker, and his board is forward thinking. So I think that companies like Epic, right now they own the market, but if they want to continue to own the market when the next wave of leaders comes in, they're going to have to really make some serious changes rather than being the big guy. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the future of medicine leadership, and I don't mean medicine, healthcare leadership, is you have to think differently. There's going to be alliances that you wouldn't even consider right now. It might be that Epic and Athena might create something together. Who knows? And at the end of the day, if we want truly integrated systems, you're going to need that sort of common communication between all these different EMRs. And a perfect example is we're affiliated with Fairview that uses Epic. And the university is affiliated with Fairview, and they just finally transitioned to Epic in the last couple of years. But in my practice, which is a private practice, we use a different system. And we fax them our notes, and they scan them in. But wouldn't it be cool if it all sort of showed up?
Yeah.
You know, and yet we're a small group like ours, we can't afford Epic because it's very expensive. And there was a group in town that literally went bankrupt. They had to close because of their Epic purchase. So, but, you know, that's the future. We have to all figure out how to talk to each other in real time. And in a closed system, like Mayo has a fully integrated closed systems, but right now they have five different EMRs. So they just chose Epic. So by 2017, still 2 years away, that's when they're going to roll out their fully integrated system.
And a lot can change and will change in the 2 years.
Right.
So they're already...
They're already behind.
They're already behind, and they're already changing into what has potential to be an antiquated system by the time they actually get it integrated.
Right.
So let's turn it back and go a little bit more to you, because I'm curious to know, as a practicing physician, you still have ACEs and... You have my meds. You know, how do you balance all of that plus a family and keeping your energy, making sure that you have the energy to complete each day?
So I would say I used to be better at it than I am now, and I'm probably not very good at it right now. And I think that manifested this, you know, since October. The lack of sleep, you know, I was sleeping 3-4 hours a night maybe. Because you're always just working. And, you know, my day would start with, I'd wake up, I would do my med stuff. And about 8 or 9, I'd go to the clinic or hospital. And then during the day, I'm still taking calls, etc. And then I'd finish up, I'd go home, I'd see the kids for like half an hour. And then I would go back to work on my med stuff. And then I'd work until about 8 or 9, then I'd have dinner with my wife. And then she'd go to sleep, and then I'd work until I fall asleep. I don't ever push. Like, if my eyes are closing, I stop. I don't drink caffeine. I drink a lot of water. And when my body says it's time to stop, I stop. But the kids started daycare, brought home all the germs. I had my worst asthma experience in my life. Finally, 3.5 months later, getting over it. I never took antibiotics before, prescribed lots of them, and now I know how people feel on them, so I won't be prescribing as many, I suppose. So I think the balance part is, it's tough. I always knew I could do three things really well, but adding on the kids, I have to sacrifice something. Right now, that sacrifice has been ACEs for the past couple of years, but primarily because I could, because there's a great team in place, and I don't need to be involved with that, except, you know, meeting with the executive director and talking to them. But I'm working on that. I think that when I hire the CEO of MyMeds, I'll get a lot more balance. And, you know, and I don't really work on Saturdays. Unless I'm on call, I try not to work on Saturdays. So that's the one day that I play with the kids and do all that kind of stuff. And then we always have a night nanny on Saturdays so that our kids still don't sleep. So she manages them all night, so we get at least one good night of sleep.
Right.
And so that's the day that I sleep, you know, 6 or 8 hours, and then I recharge. But the balance, I'm not good at it. And it causes problems, as you can imagine. Everywhere. And so that's when sometimes you got to step back and say, here's my list, here's my priorities for today or this week, and the other stuff is just going to have to wait. And ever since I've done that, it's gotten a lot better.
Okay. How much discipline did that require on your end?
The biggest discipline is not working, because you know, when your kid, who's now 3, says, when I walk in, Daddy, turn off your phone, tells you something. especially when they want to play with phones usually. And she's like, take away your phone. So now I get it. So when I come home, I put my phone on the counter, and then I don't look at it till they go to sleep. So it's about 2.5 hours. But yeah, I mean, it's getting better. You know, we're going on a vacation next week, and I'm going to bring my computer just because we're about to launch. It's like, I timed this because the launch was supposed to be 3 weeks ago. And of course, computer delays. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to have to deal.